Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the authors and editors discuss news and events with a splash of history. Our host today is Dan Masterson. Joining him is Jim Dunnigan, well-known military author and the Dean of Wargaming. Also, joining today's show is columnist and author retired Colonel Austin Bay.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. End of the year, time to talk about what's been going on during the year and sort of wrap things up before we start the new year. Jim, what was the obvious top story is the Hamas attack. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. It was spectacular, especially from the viewpoint of the Palestinians. But its long-term impact, the Hamas has been losing the forces it mustered, as it were, in Gaza, and now they're slowly being eliminated. They got no place to go. Some of them made it to the West Bank, where the Israelis are, tracking them down and killing them. Nobody surrenders. Israel is doing the same thing in Gaza, which is a little more difficult because the Hamas has a lot of civilians to hide behind, which they do energetically and unapologetically. They call the dead civilians involuntary martyrs to the cause. That's a better favorite phrase with Islamic terrorists, for over a decade. And I think something like 20,000 Palestinians have died so far in Gaza because of the fight against Hamas. Hamas has taken losses. They've lost some senior leaders. I think Israel is starting to flood the tunnels. They want to get their hostages out, but they're getting no proof of life, as it were, from Hamas. So for all they know, the hostages are already gone. It's a sad choice. They either have to choose: do we wait, and let Hamas get away, or prepare for another attack, or do we go after them? It's grim. But in grand scope of things, that's not much. The big deal was in Ukraine. That is a near-peer war. Two relatively equal forces going after one another. Now, NATO is supplying the Ukrainians, but the Ukrainians are doing the fighting. The Ukrainians, they prefer to have manpower from, NATO, but they'll take all the weapons they can get. They've been doing, quite well with them. They're basically waging a counteroffensive. Although NATO and especially the United States have dialed down on the equipment they're sending them. If the United States is noted for anything, it's bad timing. But what are you going to do? Democracy, as Churchill pointed out, is the worst form of government, except for all the others. And we're seeing that in action because the Russians are having a bigger problems in that their economy is starting to weaken dramatically. And Putin, the latter-day Stalin, is saying, tough it up. He basically believes, with some justification, that Russians do best when they're under the most duress. But the problem here is Russia is not being attacked. Russia is the attacker. And that is becoming a little more embarrassing. In fact, there was at the end of the year, Putin is in the custom of having an open house, on the net, visually. He basically allows people to pop in around the periphery around him with questions, which aren't screened. A big mistake. And most of them were critical of the way Putin was handling things, especially the war in Ukraine. Because again, as a lot of Russians point out, in Ukraine, the Russians are the Nazis. I mean, they're the ones invading. Everybody talks about World War II and the Germans, the Nazis invading Russia. Well, now it's Russia invading Ukraine under the auspices of putting Ukraine back into Russia, which the Ukrainians are resisting, and they're fighting the Russian Nazis. So, it goes round and round. and eventually the chickens come home to roost, which is happening with Russia. Putin, I don't know what he's going to do. He's not making much progress economically or militarily. And propaganda-wise, he took a real beating in his latest, you know, town hall, as it were. When Russians were given a chance to come right out and say what they thought, they didn't think what he wanted them to think. So, that's not going to end well. I think the Ukrainians will eventually prevail, despite the, how should I put it, the weak-hearted, you know, the weak-hearted support of NATO, which is now, you know, they're bickering among themselves. The Germans, I'll give them credit. The Germans pointed out publicly in their parliament that they are next in line. I mean, the Poles are there. The Poles agree. The Poles and the Germans, believe it or not, are talking about some kind of military alliance where you'd have German troops stationed in Poland. Who would ever think that would happen? And just to discourage the Russians, the Baltic states the same way. In fact, they're all already rounding up their Russian-speaking minorities and double-checking for their loyalty. I don't know how well that's going to work out, but the Baltic states, especially I think it's Estonia, has a problem where they have a major minority. I think it's about 20% of the population is Russian. And as far as I know, those Russians have proven very loyal in the past. They do not want to be ruled by Russians. They see what's happening. A lot of them have, you know, family on the other side in Russia, and they communicate by the internet and have what have you, or visit, and they realize that it's much better in the Baltic states under Western rules than it is in Russia under Vladimir Putin's rules. So it's the same old story. We've got ourselves a mess. It's difficult to get out of, but I think eventually they will. I mean, with Putin basically has said that he can keep this war going on indefinitely. He'll just keep fighting and keep fighting and keep fighting until the West tires of supporting Ukraine and allows it to be swallowed up by Russia. I kind of doubt that that's going to happen, because when things get that desperate, that's when NATO gets reasonable and say, hey, we better do something. Gee, why didn't we think of this before? And it goes back and forth. Ukraine wants to win their territory back. About 17% of their territory is still occupied by Russia. And that's the thing that's going to take the most effort. Russia has declared most of those occupied territories as an integral part of Russia. In fact, in the last census, I think it was 2020, the population actually went up a bit, mainly because it incorporated Crimea and several other areas, especially as part of Russia. So it's going to take a while. Russia says they're not going to stop. But, you know, they're eventually going to literally run out of gas because they haven't got an unlimited supply of economic necessities for the population or weapons. Russians are already putting most of their economic capabilities into producing more weapons. But like I say, you know, the Russians ultimately have a vote, and they're eventually going to vote, hey, we're not going to starve to support Putin's war on Ukraine. My analysis. That's it.
So, Austin, do you have a different view?
Well, I actually agree with Jim on why Ukraine is a bigger quote-unquote story than October 7th Hamas and Israel's response, multivalent response. But let me talk about Ukraine just for a second. I think the big story behind Ukraine, and Jim touches on it in the domestic politics of Russia, is the horrendous casualties that the Russians have taken. Now, you've seen in what I'll call dominant media instead of major media, dominant media, that, Ukraine's counteroffensive failed. Well, it didn't achieve a breakthrough that Ukrainians hoped for, NATO hoped for, Ukraine's allies and supporters thought they might get. But one of the key components in mechanized war and successful breakthrough on that is having air power. And we see the limits of missile and drone capabilities, at least current ones, and they don't have the same punch as close air support from F-16s. And the Biden administration was slow, and very slow, a year slow, in providing training and aircraft, F-16s, even though that now they're training going on in, was it Romania, Jim?
Romania, yes.
Yeah, and it's a really a NATO-wide effort because they're getting F-16s cascaded from several NATO nations' inventories. So tied into the so-called stalemate, it's not a stalemate when you're killing as many of the enemy as the Ukrainians are. Now, they're taking casualties, and they're smaller, but they're still, with maybe a small minority, they're still a nation in arms. And Russia, Jim was talking about that flop of Vlad's online chit-chat. There are four or five other quote-unquote national events where demonstrations have popped up, anger expressed. I mean, you know, this is in a police state. One of them including a absolute rupture of the torrent, I suppose, would be better, of scorn for some of these end-of-the-year parties in upscale oligarch Moscow. Now, they sound small, but they're so wealthy, they're making the classic mistakes of the ultra-rich, showing off, and because of the porosity of information, enough people know about it, like tens of millions of Russians know about it, and they resent it. And they're being asked, as Jim said, by Putin to, you know, we're under duress. We've got to fight. And then, hold it. We're not defending Mother Russia. Oh, you know, Jim covered that. And this is a war in Europe between two near peers is a huge, big, dominating story. Let's go back now to Israel-Hamas war. Now, the shock of that attack was extraordinary. You expect the Israeli security to be absolutely one of the best on the planet, and it usually is, but you let your guard down and look what Hamas is. So this is a big story if it were properly presented and you had a honest major media, I'll say it there, is Hamas reveals itself to be, they don't want peace. They don't want a two-state solution. They want genocide of Israelis is what they want. You know, between the river and the sea, that's what they want. That's gone. Their, you know, appeal is if they're the oppressed and Israel the oppressor. It's not gone among the propagandists and the multiculturalists in the United States and Europe that believe that crap. You've also seen Iran, and I think it was always implied, but they've triggered it. All use of their proxies for multiple front warfare. With Hezbollah and also shooting in Iraq, threats towards Bahrain, that doesn't get much coverage, but I've been looking at it, you know, stirring trouble in Bahrain because it's got a large, I think predominantly Shia Muslim, ruled by Sunni elites, and the Houthis, they're fighting their war in the Red Sea, Bab al-Mandab, you know, the choke points of Straits of Hormuz, which is right by Iran. It's a Persian Gulf going into the Arabian Sea, and then
and the Houthis are Shia rebels in Yemen.
Yeah, oh, they are. They are. They're Shia. They're another Shia. Well, and Hezbollah is pretty, overwhelmingly Shia. That's part of the Iran's Shia crescent strategy that they talk about. Well, you've seen it revealed. And what is jaw-dropping is U.S. forces' reluctance or orders not to shoot back, you know, taking, so far, taking no, well, concussion casualties is what we've heard, and shooting down in the Red Sea Houthi drones and missiles, you know, they're $50,000 missiles being shot down by $2 million U.S. missiles, but they're taking them down. But the thing is, those they ought to be offensive and going after the Houthi shooters. I said it right, actually, Iranian, because their Al-Quds force, Iranian Special Forces officers overseeing the Houthi missile offensive. So, you know, Iran's pulled the trigger. What have they gotten for it? Well, they've revealed it. Also, we NATO, because the French are operating down there as well as in the British, and the Israelis got a lot of intelligence out of this. The one thing we should have done and should be doing now is definitely be knocking out those Houthi launch sites. And you have two carrier groups over there in the Middle East to do it, but you also have U.S. assets in other places and other NATO assets to go after the Houthis. And they should be going after the Iranian proxies in Syria and Iraq. Those, I know, can be hit from NATO bases. Who knows what Erdogan is going to do in Turkey, but he has no truck with the Iranian proxies either. And there are also NATO rights to use bases. You can deny other NATO nations the right to use a base that is a NATO base and on sovereign political issues. But on this, when you're looking at a low-level shooting war where one of your key allies is being targeted, I'm saying U.S. being targeted. So, I mean, I can see what I've described very loosely here is how you carry out this kind of offensive mission that I say we should be doing. And yeah, there'll still be some shooters that survive it, but they're going to lose, especially in Yemen. They're going to lose all their stockpiles that they've got, that the Iranians have spent so much time and effort smuggling into Yemen. Who knows whether we could use Saudi bases, but it might be able to strike them. That's another option. But we really don't need Saudi air bases to take them out. So, Dan, you know, you were looking at big stories of the year. One to me is, first of all, I'm primarily, say it's a U.S. problem, but failure to get the Ukrainians high-performance aircraft to support their ground forces. I know the Russians have great anti-aircraft missile capabilities, but what I'm looking at is using those air to pump up your offensive operations. That's a failure, and then the failure by U.S./NATO to take out Iranian proxy shooters that are shooting at U.S. forces or NATO forces. Those are big stories. And I know they're being watched by China. I know there's also some cases that diplomats say, but if you shoot back, we're in a shooting war, and then you flip it back on them and say, we're already in a shooting war. Now, what are you going to do? Just expose U.S. forces to potential casualties or taking casualties? And it would calm the Houthis down, knock out their supplies, and then suddenly marine insurance rates would go down because they're not threatening to sink commercial vessels. That's the way I analyze it. Basically, I see the global import in what the Iranians have tried to do is very real. If you look at the spike in marine insurance, maritime insurance, and the rerouting of tankers and commercial vessels to go around the Cape of Good Hope instead of go through Suez. It hits everybody in the pocketbook. And I've written a couple of columns about that recently, but it was something Iran always threatened to do, and they've done it. So now you see the response, and the response should be, okay, shoot back, destroy their missile launch sites, destroy their stockpiles. So that's part of the non-story is to me a big story. Non-response is a big story.
Jim, after Hamas and Ukraine, what else has been happening this year?
Well, there's been a revolution in warfare that is sort of slipped under the news feed. And we have a piece. There's a piece coming up on the 26th, I believe, about FPV UAVs, the first-person viewer drones. And these have been used in the thousands, and they have drastically changed the fighting, the way you fight in Ukraine. Both sides have them. There's an actual electronic war going on between Ukraine and Russia, you know, jamming the signals, although you can avoid that by simply sending a drone at a specific target, you know, using GPS or dead reckoning, inertial guidance system, which is unjammable, and still hit the target. In other words, there's all sorts of innovation going there, and they're using, and thousands of these things are being destroyed each month, but they keep making new ones because they're so cheap. You know, the most high tech of these drones is you know, about $500, maybe $1,000. The ones with night vision and all sorts of electronic, you know, gadgetry. But most of them are dirt simple. You know, $500 specials, and they go in there and they just dominate the battlefield. They give you the view of whoever's doing what everywhere. And on a large front, I mean, the Ukrainian front is about 1,000 kilometers long. So there's, you can't cover it all, but you can with your drones. Yeah, these UAVs basically see everything, and a large number of them not only see things, but they're carrying an explosive payload. You know, the first ones the Ukrainians started using, you know, over a year ago, simply had a hand grenade attached, you know, with the pin being held by a ad hoc mechanism underneath it. And all the operator had to do was, when he saw a target, when he was like over a tank or a foxhole, he just hit the button and bing, the grenade armed would fall and do a lot of destruction. And they have it on film. I mean, there's a lot of videos of this happening. Not only that, but they would use these fuel air explosive grenades, thermobaric grenades, which basically create a huge cloud of fire, which goes into inside any you know, opening, whether it be a tank hatch, a foxhole, a bunker, what have you. It's a devastating weapon. It's been around for a long time, but it's a question of how you apply it. I mean, this massive use of UAVs has basically made the battlefield, you can't hide. Like I said, if you use the high-end UAVs with the night vision and thermal vision, which is more expensive, you basically rule the night. Wherever you suspect the enemy is operating, you go in there. For example, the Ukrainians, more so than the Russians, have been using this to attack Russian supplies. Now, they can't do it a day anymore because all these UAVs and a lot of them are armed. They see a Russian truck, or Russians are using remotely controlled vehicles because they're having a hard time getting Russians to drive the trucks because it's almost suicide. They're trying it at night, but now you have some of these UAVs with the night vision, and they simply detect a vehicle going down a road, and they either call in other UAVs, or they have the new tanks that NATO has sent to Ukraine, the Leopard 2s in particular, and some of the retrofitted, you know, older tanks have this fantastic night vision thermal sights and fire control system, and they have been devastating at night. Some of them go out at night simply looking for anything they can find. You know, they don't go deep in the enemy territory, but they can fire a high explosive round, you know, a couple of thousand meters accurately. And this basically forces the Russians to change the way they move. There's no more cover of night. In fact, with a lot of these new sensors, even fog or mist, they can see through. So, you know, there's no cover anymore. Yeah, again, if there's now it's wintertime and the leaves are all gone, but even when the leaves are there, you can see through them. And so this is revolutionized warfare. If the enemy has an edge in terms of the numbers of UAVs or aircraft or what have you, the enemy can be found. Ambush, forget about it. Moving supplies, forget about it. I mean, they'll just keep attacking them, and your guys... Now, this has been a problem with the Russians from day one, because the first thing the Ukrainians got were the HIMARS, you know, vehicles with the glimmer, you know, the guided rockets. And they were the first thing they went after were the Russian supplies. And that forced the Russians to move their supplies, you know, back almost 100 kilometers from the front to avoid that. But now we've supplied them with longer range, even longer range weapons, and it's 150 kilometers back they got to go. And with supplies that far back, they put them on a truck and take them to the front. They got to run the gauntlet of all these drones, you know, out looking for a target. Ah, there's a truck. Let's bomb it. Boom. And that's it. So, weather warfare, you know, without anybody really paying attention, it's not been a big newsworthy story. It's been revolutionized. It'll never be the same.
Austin, what do you think are the second tier stories?
Well, I've got another first-tier story that didn't get a lot of coverage, and we covered it a little bit, but it's India gaining a slight edge over China. I think it was really late December 2022, but then January of 2023, getting an intelligence edge on one of China's attempts to try to nudge a road a little deeper into quote-unquote disputed territory. But if you look at the if this were being handled in an international court, I think India would win on where the border is. But the Indians got the jump on the Chinese, and the Chinese were absolutely flabbergasted. Small story, but also the repercussions are, you know, China wants to bully. Not very good at doing it with India, but all of its smaller neighbors, you know, in these bilateral confrontations they do it to Vietnam, they do it to the Philippines, in some ways try to do it to Taiwan, and even try to do it to Japan. But India is a problem for Beijing because it is a huge land front, and the Indian Army is no pushover. It's actually had more combat experience than the People's Liberation Army. Some of the coverage that Jim's had on India is just, if I may say so, fabulous, because he gets into how corruption's eaten out the Indian Army combat power and how the training issues and the like, but it's still an immense and immensely powerful force, and in some cases a successfully modernized force. Not throughout, but they've got some interesting weapons that they're already fielding and could be fielding soon. That's not something that breaks through. It would break through with headlines if they went to war again. If the 1962 Sino-Indian War went super hot again, because it's not over. It's another one of these frozen wars, and of course the joke about that war is it's frozen because it's up in the Himalayas. But that happened, and it had repercussions with the Chinese and the Indians. Indians knew what they'd done. So that doesn't have the cachet of Ukraine and Israel Hamas doesn't have the attention, but it definitely happened. Oh, I remember one thing I was going to say when Jim was talking about the Germans having a base in Poland. within the last 2 weeks, Germany and Lithuania had been asking for the Germans for this, agreed to have a permanently stationed German army force, Bundeswehr force, on Lithuanian soil. Now, I'm not sure what it's going to be, but it's most likely, I mean, it's a quote-unquote defensive. It'd be a mechanized infantry units of some type with artillery and the like. But heavens, German, as Jim was saying, can you believe a German force permanently stationed in Poland? Well, you're having one permanently stationed in Lithuania. And it's not just the Germans doing it. There are rotational U.S. forces. And there's still, the Poles are still asking the U.S. to put a permanent armor brigade somewhere in Poland. Now, they're wanting us as tripwires, but they're forward deployed, and you get the tripwire effect, but then the Russians, they can't go through the Ukrainians. What are they going to do when they run into U.S., French, and German forces that are fully modernized equipment? And another story, this isn't new to 2023, but it really presents the Russians with a problem. And it's given the information porosity, it has domestic repercussions within Russia. All the Finns, you know, the Grand Duchy of Finland, isn't that what the Tsar called it, Jim, or something like that? It's not a Grand Duchy. When it is, it's a NATO ally, and it's a very heavily armed, though small, NATO nation, though. Well, I don't mean it's not small in size, but in terms of a population, but every single one of them are fighters. I mean, they've got a good slug of women in their militia and reserve groups, just like the Israelis. It's a tough nut to crack, and it's now they just signed within the last month a new agreement specifically with the United States on training, intelligence sharing, logistical help and the like. And who, you want to go to war again? The lesson, I hope, I'm kind of moving out of our subject on this, is that the Russians get, topple Putin and get a leader that just wants to concentrate on making Russia wealthy instead of going around trying to rebuild the Tsar's empire. That too many pieces of the empire are aware of, aware that they're far better off dealing with Western Europe and having a Western European governmental model. The Tsar, the dictator model that Putin follows, is a loser.
Jim, do you have anything else before we wrap it up?
No, that's basically it. I mean, there's been change. We've covered those, and we'll see more of those changes play out in 2024.
Austin?
I think that's an excellent summary. And I think, you know, somebody's going to say, why didn't you add this? Why didn't you add that? Well, I think we hit the significant points. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you gentlemen next year.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Bye.
Bye. Bye.